Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders.
Woohoo!
I'm Justin Burt, joined tonight by Dr. Chris the Chew Manchu and our wonderful producer, Sydney Angel. Hey, Sydney!
Hello!
So wonderful to have you, our super producer. This is like the 42nd episode you produced. All incredible, high-quality stuff. Another great one tonight. Our guest tonight, Dr. Abby Donaldson, here to discuss restrictive eating disorders and anorexia nervosa. Before we dive into content, hey, Chris, can you remind us about the show?
Yes. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Abigail Donaldson. Dr. Donaldson is board certified in both pediatric and adolescent medicine. She is an associate clinical professor of pediatrics at the Warren Alpert Medical School at Brown University, the division director of adolescent medicine at Hasbro Children's Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, and the medical director of the Hasbro Eating Disorders Program. Her eating disorder clinical experience involves both outpatient and inpatient collaborative interdisciplinary management, with a focus on the inpatient care of medically compromised adolescents with restrictive and purging-related illness. She is passionate about supporting others in early identification and treatment of this complex, treatable family of illnesses.
This was such a great episode. Restrictive eating is such a core peds topic. It's actually the third most common chronic illness in pediatrics after diabetes and asthma. It's also the second highest mortality mental health diagnosis, only under opiate use disorder, an opiate overdose. So incredibly high yield topic today. Dr. Donaldson, she teaches us about the SCOF screener, how to start a conversation with the patient and family about restrictive eating, and that three-legged stool that you need to help get outpatient treatment underway for your patients. So without further ado...
I don't know. I think we should get our knives and forks out and then take in as much as we can of the episode.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, we'll take it. Dr. Abby Donaldson, welcome to the Cribsiders. So excited to have you. Thanks for coming on to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
This is super exciting to have you. Another person from the Cashlock Hospital is the name what we call our hospital. We're in the same branch of Cashlock Hospital, me and you, Abby. So I feel like this is like a great team effort. But before we really dive into some content today, would love to get to know you better. Our listeners would love to get to know you better. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe a one-liner about who you are and maybe outside of medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am an adolescent medicine, as you had mentioned, but I'm also a parent of two. I have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I really love being outside. So pretty much anything out of doors, the sweatier, the better usually. But I do like to relax outside as well. And I'm really very passionate about keeping adolescents in the conversation. So I think that's a big driver of my professional life, but also outside of work. I want to make sure that the adolescent voice is heard.
Love that. And actually, Abby, you were the one who also made us realize the Cribsiders is not just the baby crib, but the adolescent's crib of,
that's right,
of their house. And so this episode is another form of the Cribsiders. I'm pretty excited that we've kind of expanded our boundaries for that now.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, we got to take care of that second decade in the Cribsiders.
Right.
You know, the crib is it's just important as the other crib.
We take care of kids from crib to crib. You know?
That's exactly right. See, I'm keeping him in the conversation.
Nice. I think my question will be, is there anything that you would recommend recently that you've enjoyed in popular culture, whether it's a book, a movie, a TV show that you would recommend to our audience that people should check out?
Oh, that's a good question. Everything I've watched lately has to do with small children, which... it's fun. I go with my kids, you know? So I did see Migration and it was pretty funny. The movie Migration.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's out in the theaters right now. It's pretty funny. It's an animated movie, so if you're into that. I also just went to a Bruins game, which was fun. I haven't been to a Bruins game in a really long time, and it was a big shootout on President's Day, so that was exciting. My kids were asking why they were fighting. Like, there was actually a fight on the ice, and my 10-year-old was like, his eyeballs were going to pop out of his head. I was like, that happens in hockey sometimes. It's okay. He's like, but Mom... So it was an event for everybody.
That's very wholesome.
Yeah, it was fun.
As the adolescent medicine provider, I thought you were maybe going to be like, "Oh, Euphoria is really great. I watched a lot of Euphoria."
No, I don't consume a lot of adolescent content. I love adolescents, but I wouldn't say that I seek to embody their brains.
Yeah,
inhabit their brains.
Sounds right. That's right.
I had enough of that when I was a teenager myself. Yeah. I think.
Oh man, I would love to see what your 10-year-old would have to say to the Bruins players if he had a chance to go down
question.
And then mediate that conflict.
Yeah.
My question is, can you just maybe share a piece of advice that you've received as either a learner or a teacher or just along the trajectory of your career?
Yeah, so that is also a really good question. The one piece of advice that I try to keep with me all the time, I received as a fellow from one of my mentors at Hopkins, or as a fellow. And he really tried to focus on helping us understand the fellow group, understand that, you know, there were going to be lots of decisions, a lot of opportunities in the course of a person's career. But if you could identify your priorities and keep things kind of orienting towards those priorities, it would really help you to figure out what you want to take on and what you don't want to take on. Because even the most interesting project can sometimes really deviate from where you're heading. And sometimes that's really good. So you can intentionally decide, I know this is not aligned with my goals necessarily, but it's something I really care about. Or you can, it gives you permission to say, you know, that sounds really interesting, but I'm busy and I only have so much time. And I know my horizon. I know the like lighthouse on my horizon. So I'm going to keep heading for the lighthouse, and like, best of luck with your tangential steamboat going in the other direction. That'll be on someone else's lighthouse horizon. So I think that's like, I think about that all the time because, you know, it's complicated when you're a parent and a doctor and a teacher and a mentor and like you're trying to kind of help other people along. It's just a really powerful image for me.
I love that. And I am so glad that coming on as a guest on a pediatric medicine podcast made it onto your steamboat horizon trajectory.
Yeah. We're part of the narrative. We're part of the horizon now. This is great.
This steamboat was cool enough that I was like, I'm getting on that boat. I'm going to do it.
Oh, we made it. We are happy to have you aboard and are very excited for this episode, especially. We'll dive into some content. We're talking about eating disorder, something that comes up a lot and is often, you know, talked about in pediatric, whether outpatient or inpatient.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners. We've been talking about Freed for the last few weeks, and I thought I should give you a bit more of a background. So Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. We've kind of told you that part already. But what's new is the background. So Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Erez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who was spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks. So clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on what they do best. Most importantly, Freed is HIPAA compliant. It learns your style over time, just like any human scribe. At $99 per month, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. But good news, Cribsiders listeners, you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of the Cribsiders podcast can use code CRIB50 for $50 off their first month. That's code CRIB50 for $50 off that first month.
So let's dive in. Sydney, you want to start us off with our first case?
Absolutely. All right. So this is our first case from Cashlec Children's. You are seeing Rafaela, a 14-year-old with a history of adjustment disorder with anxiety, currently on no medications, and you are seeing her at Cashlec Children's Primary Care due to parental concern for weight loss. When reviewing her chart before you go in, you notice that her weight and BMI percentiles have dropped since her last visit, and she currently has a BMI of 17. Her blood pressure is 94 over 65 and pulse is 65. When you talk with her, she says that she is sick of people nagging her to eat and that she just feels fat. When her parent mentions the weight loss, Rafaela adds, "Yeah, and my body was so gross at my old weight." She has a few friends at school, but also reports having been bullied during lunchtime in the past year. Her parents add that her maternal grandmother makes a lot of comments about her own weight and feeling fat in Rafaela's presence. So obviously a lot of different pieces and directions we can go from there. Just to start, can you talk a little bit about kind of the epidemiology and presentation of disordered eating?
Yeah, so eating disorders are really very common, and they're increasingly common. And I think it's important to be careful in talking about eating disorders. A lot of people talk about eating disorders, and they really are talking about anorexia. But when we talk about eating disorders, we're really talking about all the eating disorders. So anorexia, bulimia, unspecified feeding or eating disorder, avoid a restrictive food intake disorder, binge eating disorder. And to some extent, you know, these aren't in the DSM-5, but things like pica or rumination are kind of eating disorder related. And so when we think about it on that scale, it makes it easier to kind of wrap your head around how many people actually are struggling with eating disorders. And relatively recently, there was a study that came out between 2018 and 2022. Health visits related to disordered eating more than doubled among people under the age of 17. And about, you know, again, looking at epidemiology is tough, but, you know, around 4% to around 8% of adolescents are struggling with an eating disorder. So it's pretty common. And there is another study that I recently kind of blew my mind. I think it was published in JAMA last year in 2023. And it showed that almost a quarter of kids internationally, so 6-year-olds to 18-year-olds, have screen positive for eating disorders. So whether or not they have a full-blown eating disorder diagnosis or whether they are just, they have some thought patterns and behavior patterns that are consistent with eating disorders. So this is like a really serious, really pervasive international problem. And it's key to keep that in mind.
To that point, you know, I think today we're going to talk, try to focus a little bit on anorexia nervosa, but, you know, more broadly, what are the kind of the core things that maybe bring all of this together? Are they all forms of body dysmorphia? Are they all forms of, you know, a matter of control? Are there things that are either early warning signs or things that providers, you know, in the screening process can ask about with body image? How do we kind of start finding people who are at risk for some type of disordered eating or eating disorders?
It's really hard to generalize what, you know, one little nugget. I guess from a 10,000 foot perspective, an eating disorder is really a change in thought patterns that prompts changes in behavior related to eating or activity. So, and then that becomes kind of a reinforcing concept. So let's say you have a stressor in your life, parents get divorced, and it's coming up on summer, and you really want to look good in your bathing suit, and you want to look muscular and toned. And so you decide to change the way you're eating and exercising to try to achieve a more toned body. And so then you start working out, people tell you look great, you put on your bathing suit, look in the mirror, you feel really good. And then it sort of becomes this reinforcing cycle. And I sometimes think about it or describe it as like a whirling cycle. And then things start to kind of spin out of the whirl. So, you know, you end up with problems with social function, emotional function, physical function, developmental function, and everything kind of starts to go off the rails. So for a practitioner who's questioning an adolescent about their wellness, let's say at a well visit or a sick visit for weight loss like this patient, you really want to try to get at like what has changed for that kid. What are they thinking that's different? When did they start to think differently about their body? And what are they doing to achieve their goals? And then you can talk about the concrete specifics. Because when you ask a kid, you know, how do you feel about your body? That's a pretty hard question for a teenager to answer, or anybody really, probably. But when you ask a kid who's lost some weight, like in this example, you know, when did things start to change for you? they will be able to identify when things started to change. And then you can use their language to reflect back. Okay, you said, you know, you got bullied at school. How, you know, where did that go next? Or when was the bullying happening? And it was happening at mealtime, so they stopped eating lunch. And then they, you know, you can kind of take it from there. The groups that are at highest risk are kids who are probably, not surprisingly, the kids who get missed for a lot of things. But when we think about stereotypical eating disorder patients, a lot of people imagine an underweight white girl from a higher socioeconomic class. And so the kids who are actually at highest risk for being missed are the kids who do not fit into that. There was a study last year that showed more than half of kids who are transgender, for example, have manipulated their weight using things that are consistent with eating disorder behavior, so restriction or purging or over-exercising to change their body, which makes sense in some ways, but it's clearly maladaptive. And it makes sense in that a person who is trying to change their, align their body with their identity might make those kind of changes. Sorry, I kind of mangled that a little bit.
That was great. That was so much information. I'm wondering, recognizing that it doesn't fit a stereotype necessarily, obviously this case, we're already veering off the case, we're on question number two, but this case, they're coming in for a sick visit. There's already this concern that's been identified, but recognizing that we may miss that, what might we see in just like a well child visit that would lead us to ask more questions about it? Or should we be doing some sort of general screening question of all kids? And what would that look like in a way that is maybe not launching into a conversation that a kid doesn't want to have? Can you just talk a little bit about that, navigating starting the conversation there?
Yeah. So I, as a medical provider, I feel like part of my job is easier because you can rely on the physical information that you have access to. So for this patient, you have a couple of things. You have her weight loss. So she's lost a bit of weight. You have their concerns. They're coming in saying, we're worried about this. You have her weight loss. You have her blood pressure is kind of borderline low. Heart rate's, again, kind of borderline in the lower end of normal. BMI is a little on the low side. So you have some things that you can start the conversation with. And I think for a lot of patients, they know that something has changed. So when you as the doctor or the nurse practitioner or person involved with their care, nurse or whoever else is seeing them, say like, hey, I see that your weight has changed. Do you have any idea what that's about? Or is that been intentional? Is that something that is happening on purpose or by accident? And then you can expand your review of systems so that you can kind of figure out, like, you know, is this weight loss related to an eating disorder, or is this weight loss related to like IBD or something else completely? Because there are lots of reasons people lose weight. There is a questionnaire called the SCOFF questionnaire. So it's a 5-question, easy to administer questionnaire that you can use in the office, and it is validated and has been used for a long time. It's an imperfect tool like many screeners, but it does capture quite a number of particularly restrictive and purging eating disorders. And then you can use that in expanding your questioning as well.
That's awesome. That's a great tool, and we'll link it to the show notes. And it sounds like that can be a reasonable screening for eating disorder behaviors. And so for our patient, let's say, you know, we're identifying some of the early warning signs, we're acknowledging that these are the concerns. Let's say their SCOFF score is, we all know what a SCOFF score is, that would be worrisome. So let's just, you know, say that
greater
it was a worrisome SCOFF score. Beautiful, it's greater than 2, thank you. Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. A SCOFF score greater than 2. What are our next steps? If, you know, how do we make a diagnosis of restrictive eating, or a diagnosis of anorexia nervosa, or, you know, is there a defining line between, you know, restricting behavior and making the diagnosis of anorexia?
For sure. And so the DSM-5 has put out, obviously, clinical diagnostic criteria. And those are the ones that you want to try to use if you're going to make that diagnosis. And so for anorexia, the criteria are pretty simple. It's restriction of food intake leading to weight loss or maintenance of weight at less than about 85% of an appropriate body weight for that person. They suggest that BMI less than 17.5 is appropriate, but I think that underappreciates the range of sizes of people that develop eating disorders. And so, you know, our clinical team typically will use that less than 85% of of a healthy weight for that person. And a healthy weight for that person is usually determined to be the weight that they were healthy before they changed their eating behaviors and started losing weight. And so that is actually a tough one for people to wrap their heads around. And I'm happy to talk more about that if you're interested. But there's also the fear of fatness or weight gain that's really critical. So if a kid is losing weight and they say, I really, really want to gain weight, I'm scared, I don't know what's happening, they probably don't have anorexia if they're telling you the truth. And you can get to whether they're telling you the truth. It's not always in the first conversation, but you'll figure that out. I think that some people get hung up on that, but you will figure that out. They also need to have a distorted body image. You know, they look in the mirror or they compare themselves to others and they say they are enormous compared to someone next to them, but they're actually cachectic. And we have patients in the hospital all the time who will say things like, you know, I couldn't possibly gain any weight. I'm already so big. And they're hospitalized for malnutrition. So that really gets to the nugget of the psychiatric thought disturbance that goes along with eating disorders. And then for anorexia, there are two types. There's a restricting type where it's just restricting the diet to as little as possible and no purging or binging behavior. And then there's a binge purge type where there's like this sort of baseline restrictive behavior that's punctuated by periods of binging and then purging. And purging can be vomiting, which I think is the one people first think of, but it also can be laxatives or diet pills or diuretics or overexercise. Anything that's designed to eliminate the calories consumed is considered a purge. And the DSM has, you know, diagnostic criteria for all of them. So you can go through and really make the diagnosis. If you aren't sure or they don't hit all those points, then you can make the diagnosis of unspecified feeding or eating disorder and move on. And for someone who's malnourished, really, on some level, what we call it isn't as important as how we manage it. You call it a problem and you nourish that person back to health.
Maybe this is a great time in a primary care outpatient clinic. Again, let's say with this case where it's pretty clear that there's an eating disorder going on. It's pretty clear that we asked some more questions and it's clear that there's some restrictive eating, maybe with a clear stressor. What kind of language do you use to start talking with the family about this, either about the diagnosis or generally next steps? And I think especially we have a previous episode called Weight, Weight, Don't Tell Me. It was a great episode about health at any weight. And one of the big takeaways was, you know, really ensuring that there's no body shaming or putting emphasis on like a specific thing on the scale. And I think that can make these conversations a little more difficult where you're wanting to avoid creating any feelings of shame. And so how do you talk to the child or the caregiver? Or what kind of language do you use to say, you know, this is what I'm worried about. This is what I think needs to be the next steps.
Yeah, I will usually say actually what you just said. So I will say, I'm worried about you. And this is why I'm worried about you. And this is what I think is going on. And the why is based on the evidence. So, you know, you've lost, the Society for Adolescent Health and Medicine has put out this really helpful clinical guideline. And one of the things that they put in there is the rates of weight loss that should be considered concerning. So when you have a person, and this comes up more often in people who are in larger bodies, so they'll lose a large amount of weight, but their BMI is still 30, let's say, or 40. But they've lost like 50 pounds in 4 months or something like that. You can kind of quantify. So you can use that kind of those weight classes, weight loss categorizations to say you've lost so much weight that we would now consider you severely malnourished. And the result of that severe malnutrition is that we're seeing changes in your blood pressure. We're seeing changes in your heart rate. At that point, you would have asked the kid about, you know, in getting the history, you would have asked them about like physical function and emotional function. Let's say they're a field hockey player and they're getting really tired at practice. They're not socializing with friends. They don't go out to the field hockey dinners anymore because they don't want to eat in front of people. They're isolating. So you can use all of those pieces to kind of talk about why I'm worried. When you think about a 14-year-old just starting out in her adolescence, those things are really critical. Not going to the field hockey dinner is a big deal. So it may, you know, it may not be a life-threatening thing to not attend that kind of event, but it's a thing that is not normative in her peer group. So of course, the medical stuff is near our wheelhouse, and I can sort of say, you know, these are the medical things. If you frame it as I'm worried about you, it becomes much less, it becomes much harder for the patient to kind of bark back at you, well, I don't have an eating disorder, right? If I say, I think you have anorexia nervosa, and this is why, they're going to be like, I don't have anorexia. But if you say, I'm worried about you, and here are the reasons why I'm worried about you, it becomes much harder for them to say, I don't have anorexia nervosa, because you don't actually say you think they have anorexia nervosa until the end of that conversation. I'm worried about you because of all these things. And I think you might have anorexia nervosa. And here's how we're going to treat this problem. And it is a very treatable problem. So you kind of frame it that way. And I think you can sort of orient towards mobilizing for care. It becomes much more difficult when you meet resistance. So resistance from the patient is to be expected. Sometimes you meet resistance from the parents, and that becomes more difficult. And so, you know, I function in a primary care capacity, but also subspecialty capacity. And as a subspecialist, by the time they get to me, they know why they're coming. And so we can talk about it. But in primary care, it's actually pretty hard. It's pretty hard because they'll be like, well, I don't think so. I don't really want to do this. Can we talk about whatever my vaccines? Or they try to sort of move the conversation along.
Totally.
And so it is much, much more difficult. And I laugh. I mean, I talk about this all the time with residents because it's funny having the experience of being on both sides in adolescent medicine. That's one of the things I really love about it. But I have to stay humble in the subspecialty arm of my work because I get burned on the primary care end on this conversation.
That's humbling. And it's nice to hear. It's very validating because it is a difficult conversation. And I think, you know, I think as providers sometimes with this, but other diagnoses too, it's like, aha, I have the, you know, I know what's going on. And then the patient's like, no, I don't want to like go along this line of things. I'll do a flu shot before I talk anymore about this.
I was going to say, the adolescent would rather get a shot in the arm than actually talk about this.
That's right. That's right. The other thing that sometimes is productive, and I think this is the thing people forget about as a strategy for managing this conversation is if you go through this and they're like, no, no, I don't think that's what's going on. I think you have it wrong. You can be like, yeah, you know, I might actually have this wrong. But here's what, in any case, I know you're malnourished because of these like 25 things that we've just talked about. And so in any case, you're going to need to eat more. And you're going to need to rest your body so that you can recover, so that your blood pressure improves and your heart rate improves and your physical, emotional health. And then oftentimes it'll really declare itself when it's pushed in treatment. So if you get the kid eating or trying to eat, you get them engaged in therapy, you get them engaged with a dietitian, and they do beautifully, which does sometimes happen. Teenagers don't often know how to feed themselves properly. So it's entirely possible that this patient, 14, you know, she joined the field hockey team for the first time. She's exercising 3 hours a day because she wants to, you know, do her very best. And she just lost a bunch of weight because she doesn't know how to feed herself and she's eating Doritos for lunch, right? And so some kids, it's just an absence of understanding the importance of fueling their bodies through adolescence. And when you give them the information, they will do it. And then there are other kids who have an eating disorder, and it's not an information problem. It's another problem but oftentimes you have to kind of peel back the layers a little bit before you can actually get to that central discussion. So you have to be patient.
So I guess, you know, moving on from, so say we have a likely diagnosis, or we decide to say unspecified, you know, we've sort of talked to the patient, hopefully got their parents involved. You were saying that this is sort of a malnutrition type of disease as well, right? So like, what are the type of things when I'm in primary care that I want to do is like, all right, you're losing a lot of weight. What tests do I need to order to make sure that we're healthy, that we can continue to move forward, at least management in the outpatient, or things that we might need to test to say we need to do this on an inpatient standpoint? Like, what are tests that you order?
The tests that we typically will order for eating disorder evaluation are kind of fall into two categories. One is establishing a baseline, sort of understanding where we're at. So for example, like, does this kid have a critical hypokalemia that we really need to hospitalize right now? And then the other is to make sure there's nothing else going on. Because again, there are lots of things that can cause weight loss or loss of appetite or changes in emotional, physical function. And so we want to make sure we're not missing something else, like a thyroid problem would be kind of a classic example of that, where things may look really different if you have hypothyroid or hyperthyroid. And sometimes that can masquerade a little bit as an eating disorder. So typically I'll get like a complete metabolic panel where you're looking at the electrolytes and renal function and liver function and kind of broad strokes. In our program, we typically will do a TTG-IGA, just kind of looking for celiac, like again, broad strokes, because celiac can fly under the radar into adolescence and cause some of the same symptoms. We'll get thyroid testing. We'll get a vitamin D level because any kind of form of malnutrition is going to compromise bone health. So as we're getting going on a treatment plan, we really want to make sure that we're optimizing their bone health. We typically will get a prolactin level for kids who are vomiting, just exploring, you know, other causes of vomiting. Sometimes we'll get an amylase, urine pregnancy test. Many kids who menstruate will not get a period, and some of them are pregnant. So we check that. And then we think about doing a DEXA scan for anybody that's been malnourished for more than 6 months, because again, they are at pretty high risk for osteopenia. And that's what the recommendation is, you know, 6 months of malnutrition. Used to be 6 months of amenorrhea, but we do check DEXAs in males as well, because the bone, you know, they have bone health implications, although not quite as clear cut as the estrogen components of a menstruating female. And those are the big ones. We get an EKG for everybody.
Everyone?
Yep, pretty much everyone. If they've lost a lot of weight, I mean, if their vitals are totally normal and their physical exam is fine, you could wait on the EKG. But, you know, by the time you're thinking about hospitalization, that's a good thing to check. And the thing a lot of people will say, well, my labs are normal, so I'm healthy. And with most anorexic patients, actually, their labs are normal. Because, again, the body's really good at adapting. So even if it's getting very little nutrition in, it's going to hang on to the things that it needs. And it's going to mobilize resources elsewhere. So it's going to metabolize bones and muscles and other body tissue to get what it needs to stay alive. And that's where the refeeding syndrome concerns come in, is because, you know, it goes from a total body depleted state to having enough of everything. But then the shifts of electrolytes across the cellular membranes can cause problems early in refeeding.
So normal labs don't necessarily tell you that this is a patient that would be a good candidate for outpatient versus inpatient treatment then.
That's right. And the place we'll see most abnormalities is in kids who purge. But restrictive eaters really typically do have very normal labs. And so again, that Society for Adolescent Health and Medicine clinical from November 2022 in the Journal of Adolescent Health is really helpful in outlining the physical changes that you look for a medical hospitalization. So eating disorders are also interesting in that they fall in this crevice between the medical world and the psychiatric world. Of course, like, you know, I really would love to see us eventually come together where we belong, but the whole hospital and insurance and everything else, infrastructure, is separate. And so you can hospitalize someone in a psychiatric setting when they're still medically stable because their thought processes are so distorted. Let's say a person is unable to eat more than 500 calories a day, but they have not critically problematic physical function, they could go into a residential or partial program for eating disorders that's much more therapeutic forward. Typically, those last for weeks or months. The medical hospital is really reserved for kids who have complications of their malnutrition. So critical bradycardia is probably the most common reason for admission, but significant orthostasis or really, really rapid weight loss are things that we will admit them for.
Our next case, we're going to get into inpatient, and I'm very much looking forward to learning about what kind of that treatment will look like and what the workup will look like once you get into that setting. Before we jump over to that, do you mind sharing a little bit what treatment would look like in the outpatient setting, including how do we create a meal plan? What would be the ideal form of therapy to be referring patients to? What do we do in primary care versus what would we expect to refer out for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I often talk about eating disorders as like a three-legged stool. Eating disorder treatment is a three-legged stool. Medical, therapist, dietitian. And if you don't have all three legs of the stool, it's going to be wobbly and you're not going to be able to sit on it very well. And so families will try to dodge the therapy and they will also try to dodge the nutrition. I think oftentimes in medicine, we're the first people they bring the concern to. So they come to your office, just like this patient, they come to your office saying, we have a problem. And you're the medical provider. And you say, great, I need you to connect with these other people. And they're like, yeah, I don't want to do that. I don't have any time. I don't need more appointments. I want to, like, you'll just help us get better. But this is a mental illness. And I am a pediatrician. So pediatricians do a lot of mental health care and are very good at it, but we're not therapists, and we have not been trained in, you know, CBT for eating disorders or family-based treatment or DBT for, you know, like there are lots of modalities that we can use for eating disorders, but I might be able to provide support around medications or triage for a suicidal assessment or something like that, but I can't do that longitudinal care, nor should I try, right? And so if the kid is not in therapy, the kid is not getting treatment for their eating disorder. And I think that's just really important to keep at the forefront of your mind if you're going to tiptoe into this water as a primary care provider, because it's going to be tempting to just try to do it yourself. And so the therapist is key. Family-based treatment is kind of the gold standard first-line recommended treatment for eating disordered patients, but it's a little bit harder to apply to some family systems because it really relies strongly on mobilizing and empowering parents to feed their children and have the child be completely separated out from feeding themselves. And so in a family, let's say, where there's one parent and that parent might work multiple jobs, where the kid is maybe alone for periods of time, it's just really hard to execute. So that is the first line to consider, but may not be the reality for some patients. Cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy are also very effective for eating disorders. And so those are the ones that you generally want to try to aim for. It is important to try to find a therapist who has experience with eating disorders to some degree, because not all therapy is better than no therapy in eating disorder management, as many other things. And then the dietitian, similarly, trying to find somebody that has some experience with eating disorders is not going to be a dietitian who's focused on weight loss. Unfortunately, you know, I think some dietitians are more focused on quote unquote healthy eating than eating to fuel the body appropriately, and kind of using a healthy eating model that includes things like, you know, Häagen-Dazs ice cream and chips sometimes and like other things that are going to nourish that kid. So you need to collaborate, which creates some complexity. In the medical office, typically, you know, you can follow patients with eating, you should follow patients with eating disorders as a primary care provider. It's not extremely complex. You need to be kind of organized and see the kid regularly, but it's mostly an exercise in being patient and keeping them on track, helping to keep them on track and helping them to see a future without the eating disorder. Those are things that you as a pediatrician are going to be better at probably than some of the other members of the treatment team.
So what does this type of follow-up look like? They see you in clinic, like, are you seeing them weekly? Are they seeing also the dietitian weekly, and then doing the CBT twice a week? Like, I don't even know if I have a concept of what this type of follow-up looks like, and the amount of work that will have to be put in by both the patient and their families.
Yeah. So typically in a kid who's pretty sick, like a kid who you're really worried about, you want to see that kid every week in the office, in the medical office. If you think they might need the hospital, you should follow them every 1 to 2 weeks. If they are reasonably stable, even if they're still losing weight slowly, but reasonably stable, and they have a therapist and they have a dietitian, the medical provider can pretty quickly start to take a back seat. And so seeing the kid every 3 to 4 weeks is not unreasonable. And once the kid is really engaging with the therapist and has started to gain weight, you can back off a little further. I think abrupt change in this field is not a good idea, and making decisions based on one visit is not a good idea either. So I will often say to my patients, like, I don't make any decisions based on one data point. Like, I'm going to need to see you again in a couple weeks and we'll see where your weight's going, or we'll see where your heart rate's going before we make any decisions. Obviously, if something's critical, you need to respond. But if something sort of seems like the writing's on the wall, wait a little longer and see, and be transparent with the kid about that. I really love where this is heading. Let's see if we can keep up the momentum. Or, you know, I'm really worried where this is heading. If things aren't turning around by the next time I see you, I may need to have you think about coming into the hospital. I would also just say treatment takes a long time. So the average length of treatment for an eating disorder is 3 to 5 years. And so families often will come in and they're like, all right, what can we do? They're like ready for the sprint to the finish line. And this is not that kind of problem. And as physicians, I think we're often not great at being that patient. Like, we want to fix the problem. But this is a problem where you just need to be patient. It's not often obvious that it's working right away. I think that's one of the things. I talk to a lot of pediatricians in the community who call me with questions, and we try to problem solve and keep them in their office if that's what they want to do, or expedite them coming to see us if that's what they want to do. And a lot of times it's just sort of like, this doesn't feel like it's working. It's like, well, no, sometimes it doesn't feel like it's working, but you just have to kind of like hang in there and call me if you want me to remind you that it's totally working. You just need to hang in there.
So one question I have is, say I'm a general pediatrician, a primary care doctor who's seeing a child with an eating disorder. Say I don't feel comfortable. I didn't have the three parts of the legs of the stool, and so I've sent to a specialist. What are the things when they come back to me as their primary care, do I need to worry about? And maybe what are some nuances that we need to be paying attention to? I think, for example, you know, I have a patient who has an eating disorder. In my version of our EMR, we get this thing called an after-visit summary, which always prints out the weight. And it's our policy that this after-visit summary, at least until recently, has to be printed out. I used to run to the front desk and I would cut out the weight in there before giving it to them. Now there's been an update and you can actually delete it from there before it even prints out. But, like, you know, I have another patient who, you know, they have to have their vitals when they come in. So we always weigh them backwards so they don't actually see what's on the scale. Are there nuances like that that we need to be paying attention to? And what are some other things we need to be following up as the primary care doctor?
Yeah, so weights are tricky that way, because some approach, so actually family-based treatment, one of the primary focuses of family-based treatment is collaborative weights. So the patient actually sees their weight. And eating disorders, a lot of eating disorders are kind of in the anxiety family. So they're anxiety-adjacent illnesses. And part of FBT, you know, is that if you repeatedly expose patients to these stressful, averse things, they will develop a skill set to tolerate them better, and then they will recover, right? Which, if you think about, you know, like a hierarchy of fears, this is kind of working on that model to some extent. And so if I think it's up, it's kind of up to you in your clinical practice and how you want to approach it. You're not going to break someone by telling them what their weight is, but you need to be able to talk to them about, like, you need to be able to process it with them after, right? So if you're going to be a practice where you're going to show the weights, you need to be prepared to spend a few minutes of that visit talking about the weight change or answering questions about it and being like, I'm not going to talk about that with you. This is what's happening, and we're going to move on. In our office, we don't do collaborative weights because we found that it just takes up so much of the conversation. Families will focus on weight as like a proxy for wellness or progress. And a kid might be making tremendous progress in the way that they're thinking about food and exercise, but it may not yet have translated to change in their eating behavior. And so if you focus on the weight, you're going to take away the success of that kid being able to, you know, maybe attend the field hockey dinner, even if she's not ready to eat yet with the team. She can go and she can have a banana and feel like she's participating, which is a huge victory. But with the EMR, we're having this problem too with the portal, the patient portal. They can go in and look in their growth charts. So it's like, all right, well, why are we spending all this time trying to kind of carefully manage this piece of their care where, like, they can just log in and look at it themselves, and then they're going to do whatever they're going to do anyway. So that's something to think about with the treatment team. So if you're collaborating with others, figure out what you're going to do, or figure out with your practice, like, how are you going to approach that? Trying to get orthostatics. Orthostatics are really helpful in like telling a cardiovascular story. They do take a little bit of time, but if you have a low heart rate in an athlete and they're not orthostatic, that actually tells you pretty different information than a low heart rate in an athlete who is who is orthostatic, is not orthostatic, whether or not the athlete is orthostatic, can tell you a pretty decent amount of information. And then the other thing I would just say, you know, getting a ton of labs is not usually helpful in a patient unless they're vomiting or purging in some other way, or you suspect that they're purging. A restrictive eating patient really doesn't need a lot of labs over time. And I had another thing I was thinking of, one other thing. Oh, the physical exam. So physical exams are important with eating disorder patients. They're very subtle findings, but they're very clear findings because malnutrition is a pervasive issue, right? Like every cell in the body needs food to function. So every cell in the body is not working well when it doesn't have enough access to food. So, you know, dry skin, sunken eyes, tinnitus can sometimes occur because they lose the fat pad in the ear. And so they'll have this ringing in their ears. You know, acrocyanosis and getting a capillary refill in the toes can be really helpful and is an easy thing to compare visit to visit. In a busy office, you're not going to remember what that kid, you know, what they said or what their exam looked like. But if you can document that their capillary refill in their toes was 8 seconds and now it's 2 seconds, like that could be actually helpful in assessing a whole clinical picture. So I think some of those kind of finer exam findings, the skin is a big one too.
This is amazing. And one thing I think before going on to the next level of care of indications for getting them out of outpatient, I want to talk about that third lead that Chris was getting to as far as the medical. When should we be referring to adolescent? I mean, it sounds like these are things that if a PCP feels comfortable, they can monitor closely, continue to encourage adherence to the dietary and behavioral principles. But when should we be pulling the trigger referring to an adolescent specialist? And then maybe what does that first visit look like in the subspecialist office? Is there anything that's different that the subspecialist might be doing or having conversations about that a primary care doc isn't?
I think the specialty referral should happen whenever you as the primary care provider feel you're getting in a little bit out of your depth. And like as the subspecialist, I am not at all judgmental. I look at all the referrals for our programs. I look at a lot of referrals. And like, I'm not looking at them being like, oh my gosh, this is such a waste of time. I've never said that in my head ever. It's like, okay, you know, this person felt that this was the moment and I get the range. I get some that are like one conversation where the kid said she hated her body and they refer them to us. There's no other documentation. There's no physical exam. Like, it's like the growth chart looks fine. It's like, she doesn't like her body. So they refer to me. And then I have kids who've been working for years with their pediatrician to try to put together a care plan. And the pediatrician's really talking about the eating disorder and has a beautiful plan in place, but they just feel like they need to tag out because they've been at it for a while. And sometimes a fresh voice in the conversation can be really helpful in something like this. You know, these illnesses really depend on the patient being ready for treatment and feeling motivated. And so I think that's where, you know, a change in provider, whether it's the medical provider or the therapist or the dietitian or the whole treatment team, can breathe some fresh air into the sails and kind of keep things going towards recovery. And to get to the second part of your question, I don't actually think, you know, there's a range of pediatricians and there are a range of adolescent medicine specialists. So I guess it's unfair to say I don't think we're doing anything magically different, but I don't feel like I'm doing anything magically different than a pediatrician would do, except that 100% of my time at work is spent talking to teenagers about things that they are either ambivalent about, actively rejecting, or, you know, and that's in my primary care and my subspecialty. Mm. So like, I have a really high tolerance for a teenager being like, get out of my business. I'm like, okay, we're going to keep this conversation going. You know, like I'm really not going to get deterred by the adolescent patient. And I'm really going to talk about this very head on and directly and respectfully. And I'm not going to tiptoe around it. And I'm not going to be afraid of the feelings in the room that come up when the parent or the kid get upset. Like, I'm just going to sit through that and we're going to keep going. And I think that can be hard for a pediatrician or a generalist who just like doesn't do this all day, every day. It can feel intensely uncomfortable to be in that room if you're not in that room as sort of the part of your, you know, regular day. So I don't do well with babies, you know? So I think there are other strengths that, you know, I don't have.
I think that makes a lot of sense. That's great. Sydney, you want to tell us about our second case?
Yeah, so let's jump into our second case. Taylor is a 16-year-old who has been followed at the adolescent clinic for the past several months. Today, they are here for their follow-up appointment. As you're pre-charting, you see that they've been steadily losing weight over the past 2 months, and their heart rate is currently charted at 45. So, very different clinical picture. What are the indications that this cannot be cared for in an outpatient setting, and really just this and in other cases, when do we need to just say you need to go to the emergency room?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so heart rate is a really clear and pretty easy to admit for diagnosis. So any heart rate awake less than 50 is grounds for admission based on those SAM guidelines. It doesn't mean you have to admit everyone who has a heart rate less than 50, but you need to think really carefully about a kid with an eating disorder that you're sending home with a heart rate less than 50. You know, I think we sometimes will talk with the cardiologists at our hospital about, you know, where do we draw the line? Because they'll see kids who have much lower heart rates and are in very different circumstances than the patients I'm following. But with the weight loss, there's really not a lot else. You know, this kid's been coming to clinic. So she has anorexia, we'll assume, or an unspecified eating disorder. She's losing weight. And now she has this heart rate that's really low. So that tells a story. And when we put it in the context, it's like pretty clear this kid is going to need to come in. If you have a kid who, let's say, is weight stable or might be gaining weight and has a very low heart rate, those are the kind of scenarios where you can sort of be like, okay, like we can give it another week potentially and see. But you want to be careful about that. In the era of Fitbits, a lot of kids are sleeping with things like heart rate monitors on. And so a sleeping heart rate of less than 45 is also where the SAM guidelines draw the line. So that's in the event that you have a kid who comes in and the parent's like, oh, their heart rate was 25 last night. Like, yes, that kid needs to be admitted.
So when you say admitted, and we, you know, the question was almost like send them to the ED, like, do they actually need to go to the ED, or can we like direct admit them? Or do they need to go to the ED because they need that EKG so they can start on tele like immediately, get their lab started? Like, is there a gradation where you feel more comfortable where they can be directly admitted versus they need to go to the ED now?
And can I ask where directly admitted to? Like you talked about medical versus psych. Yes. Are we admitting them to general peds or?
Yes. So you would be admitting this patient medically. So again, medical complications of their malnutrition. And so they would come in medically. And it depends on your hospital system and the infrastructure you have available to you in terms of whether you can directly admit them. So where we are, we can directly admit. And pediatricians in the community can directly admit to our service. They just call me and we talk it through and say, great. And as long as there's a bed available, they can come into the bed and we'll get the EKG and do all the labs on the floor. Occasionally, we'll have someone who needs to transfer to the PICU, but that really rarely happens. We don't want to admit and then transfer. Like, that's not the goal, but it doesn't happen very often. That's the risk you run with a direct admit. Whereas if they come in through the emergency department, you get some of those baseline assessments done, and then you can make sure you're admitting them to the right unit. And it's usually going to be general medical versus ICU level of care. And so some adolescent medicine programs have an admitting service. Many will just do consults in the hospital and patients get admitted to the hospital medicine service. So it depends again on your children's hospital in terms of what service they would go to.
And can we talk about specific indications for hospitalization?
Yes. So we typically will use that SAM guideline and it's pretty clear cut. Basically, what you're looking for is signs of critical malnutrition compromise. So heart rate's below 50 awake, below 45 asleep, blood pressure is less than 80 over 40, orthostasis that's pretty significant. So change in heart rate from laying to standing in people less than 18, it needs to be greater than 40 beats per minute change. In people greater than 18, it's greater than 30 beats per minute change, and electrolyte disturbance that's pretty significant. In a kid, let's say, who you know is vomiting, I'll admit a kid who I know is vomiting for a potassium of 3.4, even though an emergency department physician might not recommend an admission for a patient who has a potassium of 3.4, like for a different problem, that kid could probably go home. But for a kid who's vomiting, and who's going to go home and keep vomiting, we don't know whether that's on the way down or on the way up. And I want to know before I send that kid home. So those are kind of the hard medical ones that are pretty easy for most people to like check off. There are some harder ones to assess. So things like failed outpatient treatment, dehydration, failure of growth and development, that really requires you to have an understanding of what the trajectory over time has been for that patient. And so I can't meet a kid and be like, well, they failed outpatient treatment, because they haven't really been in outpatient treatment. If they have a medical doctor, a therapist, a dietitian who's been following them over time, and they're coming to me as a subspecialist and they've been in care for a while and they're still failing, maybe I would admit that kid for failed outpatient treatment. And then other complications that make it difficult for them to execute the plan at home. So, you know, they're unmedicated and have a seizure disorder and there's lots of other stuff going on, like sort of more complicated comorbid medical stuff. So those are the big ones. And I think the other thing to be aware of in transitioning into the hospital is the medical hospital is like pretty short. So it's usually less than a week because we rely on those same admission criteria for our discharge, and insurance isn't just going to cover that kid to stay in the hospital because I don't think they're going to do well at home. That's like not a reason that anybody's going to pay for that child to stay in the hospital. And so it's worth it ahead of time to talk with the family and the kid. This is going to be a precision intervention that's going to help you start eating and start the process of building healthy habits around your eating, but it's really not going to be treatment. Like some kids come in and they go home and then they're like, all right, I'm all done. It's like, no, you did 1 week of the next 5 years of your eating disorder treatment. It's not done yet. We're just getting started. And so you got to manage their expectations around that, you know, but it is a short but powerful intervention.
And what does the hospitalization look like? What are the goals for hospitalization? What's going on in the day-to-day?
Yeah. So again, this is going to vary widely depending on whether you're in a program, you know, like ours, where we have an inpatient service and we have a protocol and we really hospitalize a lot of kids with eating disorders. We have a strong interdisciplinary team that rounds together every day versus a hospital in, you know, a more rural part of the country, let's say, where it's a PHM attending and that's it. And so I think that's just important. But the goals of the hospital stay are going to be the same in either place. They're going to be to kind of medically stabilize the kid and to facilitate a better treatment plan for outside of the hospital setting. So if the kid came in, let's say for this patient, they had a heart rate of 45 and they've lost weight rapidly. So the hospital goals are going to be to get their heart rate up above 50 a week consistently, above 45 asleep consistently, and to see that they're able to start gaining weight. If they're less than 75% of an appropriate body weight for them, that's another criteria for admission. So you could keep them in the hospital for a little while if they're, say, like 68% of their goal weight and their heart rates are good. You could keep them in the hospital for a little while, and most insurance companies will pay for that. But those are the goals, is to sort of correct the physiologic dysfunction and assert a discharge plan that's going to be more effective than the one preceding the hospital stay. And of course, to make sure that they're psychiatrically stable. I think one of the things that can happen sometimes with eating disorders is when you trap the eating disorder cognitions and sort of encourage the kid to eat in a way that they can't really avoid, you will sometimes get this like pop off distress. So maybe they weren't suicidal before, but they become more suicidal or they start to self-harm. And so you really have to be careful in the hospital about what else is happening emotionally as you are containing the eating disorder better, because it is almost never without psychiatric complications, just getting them going in treatment.
And can you talk a little bit about what the nutrition in the hospital looks like, how calories are advanced, how you kind of, as you framed it, trap the eating disorder in that context?
Yeah. So the eating disorder is going to try to impact, the eating disorder for people with eating disorders, the eating disorder is the prominent thought pattern in the brain all day. You know, kids will report that they spend 98% of their day thinking about food and activity and what they're eating. And so when you bring them into the hospital, you contain them very tightly in a system that does not have a lot of wiggle room. And sometimes patients report feeling like they're trapped, or that, you know, they're in jail. Sometimes patients will get really angry at me and be like, I feel like I'm in prison. And it's like, well, we want to make sure that this environment has no space for the eating disorder to impact your behavior. And so, and actually oftentimes the eating disorder thoughts get really loud at the beginning. There's a lot of emotional distress. And then towards the end of the hospitalization, patients are like, oh, this is so much easier because they don't, there's no room for the thoughts in the hospital. They don't, they stop having the thoughts because the eating disordered thoughts don't have anywhere to go in the hospital because the nursing team and the medical team are going to make sure they get that nutrition no matter what. So they think about other stuff, and it can be incredibly, it's an incredible relief after months or years of having this sort of monkey on their shoulder. And so in terms of the nutrition, it is really, it has been shown more recently, there's been some wonderful research that's been done out of Stanford on this topic, and they just keep churning it out. It's like they establish the new line in the sand, and then they advance it, and then they advance it, and it's great. Because previously, there'd been all this worry about refeeding syndrome, whereby, you know, a patient who's restricting their carbohydrate load, you know, their body functions in a certain way metabolically. When you add carbohydrate back in, the electrolytes shift, and you can cause all these problems with, like, all over the body, and including death. And so there's this concern that if you push too hard with the nutrition, you're going to cause other problems. And of course, we don't want to cause other problems. But this group out of Stanford with Andrea Garber has shown that it's really very safe to start even like a 2,000 or even more recently, 2,500 calories. Even for a kid who hasn't eaten anything for weeks, you can start in a hospital setting at a pretty high caloric level and then advance them to their goal, which is typically assessed by the dietitian and is dependent on, you know, where are they in their growth and development. A 14-year-old who's still not, you know, pre-pubertal, let's say, or peri-pubertal is going to have a really different goal than a person who's 20 and who's post-pubertal. And so we would assess that. And typically the goal is somewhere between 2,500 and 4,500 calories, depending on the kid. But typically we'll go up by, you know, some places will do it 250 calories every day. Some do it 500 calories every other day. You can kind of march along towards the goal and follow the physical exam and the labs looking for signs of complications. And then, you know, most of the time they get to goal within a couple of days. So it's pretty aggressive and it's really hard. It's really uncomfortable. I think sometimes, you know, patients are like, I think providers can sort of get callous to the idea that, oh, you know, you can do this, or, you know, this is my day job, and like, I'm not going to engage. But like, this is incredibly difficult. I'm blowing up this kid's life. I'm asking them to emergently change their priorities in a way that they are not on board with. And I'm making them eat these vast quantities of food, including foods that they have not eaten in maybe years, right? Of course, it's awful. And so I mean, I will talk about the dimensions of suckiness with the patients very directly, because I think it's, you're not doing them any favors if it's like, oh, you got this, you know, it's like, yeah, you do got this, but it is also really sucky. It's really hard. And we have to do it because you need to stay alive. And ultimately, you need to like thrive and live your best life, right? This is first about staying alive. And then it's about living your best life, which of course is the goal.
One of the things you mentioned about the hospitalization complications is refeeding syndrome. Can you talk a little bit about who are you concerned about? Who's at highest risk for refeeding syndrome? Or what are some of the other complications that occur in the inpatient for treating these restrictive patients?
Yeah, so refeeding syndrome is a really interesting metabolic biochemical kind of process. But the people who are at highest risk for it are people who are severely malnourished. So the studies have shown people who are less than 70% of an appropriate body weight for them. Again, understanding an appropriate body weight not to be the 50th percentile for BMI, but being where they were basically before they got sick. For some people, that'll be at the 50th percentile. Some people it'll be at the 10th percentile. Some people it'll be at the, you know, 120th percentile. So people who are less than 70% of an appropriate body weight for them, and people who have lost a really large amount of weight in a really short time. And so, you know, greater than 15% in 3 months, greater than, you know, those kind of really rapid weight loss. And so the people often, more often, who get refeeding syndrome are actually people who are in larger bodies, because looking at them from across the room, people don't identify them as malnourished, even though they may be relatively severely malnourished for themselves, right, for their own physical function. And so those are the patients that typically we want to really have a higher index of suspicion for. The physical findings and things you'll see in the labs are pretty varied. Again, all the systems in the body can be impacted. So you'll see drops in the electrolytes. predominantly potassium, phosphorus, and magnesium, but you can see changes in calcium and sodium as well. You can see increase in the liver function test, so you'll get a little transaminitis. Oftentimes the AST and the ALT will increase in the early refeeding and they'll increase a little bit. So you'll get numbers like in the 50s or in the 60s, but they kind of stabilize there. But if you see the transaminase is jumping up kind of exponentially day to day, that can be a sign of refeeding syndrome. And so you want to kind of slow down a little bit with the nutrition. On physical exam, the things that are the most effective telltales are edema. So looking for edema every day is really important in the hospital. Taking off their socks, feeling their feet, feeling their hands, you know, looking around their eyes to sort of see, do they look puffy? Oftentimes patients who are restrictive eaters and have lost a lot of weight will say they start feeling puffy and fat right as they start eating, but that's not the same as edema. So it can be harder to rely on the subjective report of the patient. For kids who have rings, that can be really helpful. Do your rings feel tighter? And then signs of cardiac overload. So crackles in the lungs, changes in cardiac sounds. Occasionally you'll see a kid. We've had a couple of kids who've had pericardial effusion. And so, you know, just kind of, again, being alert to those kind of subtle physical findings.
This is amazing. I think, you know, we've gotten to talk a lot about diagnosis, the general history taking, going into outpatient treatment, indications for a higher level of care, and really what that looks like. And I think we've kind of just scratched the surface, but this has been, you know, a very, very helpful way, I think, of kind of seeing that full spectrum. In working towards wrapping up, you know, are there main takeaway points that you think are really important for trainees and attendings and other providers who are listening to the show about taking care of patients that have restrictive eating disorders?
Yeah, I think a couple things come to mind, and I mentioned some of them before, but I think you need to pay attention to the details with this illness, this family of illnesses. Patients are pretty motivated to hide them. They are secretive illnesses, and they're very private and stigmatized. And so as pediatricians, we're in the unique position of really understanding who the patient is over time often, and there's a lot of continuity. So really paying attention for signs that things are changing and asking the kid about it. You know, don't be shy to ask the teenager, like, what's going on? Follow up, I think, is important too. Like, if you're not really sure, just see them again and take another look at it on a different day. You know, when they're in a different spot and you're in a different spot. If you have a patient who's losing weight, even therapeutically in a healthy way and like wants to lose weight and is appropriate for weight loss, don't see that kid in a year. See that kid in 3 months and just check in. How's it going? Because even if they're doing a great job with it, you can give them a high five and congratulate them and they're going to love you for that. And if they're kind of going off the rails towards an eating disorder, you're going to catch it sooner. So don't leave it that long. Like anytime you say, talk about a weight loss plan, you need to check in with that kid again and then talk about it when you see it. I know that's so hard. And for some people, you know, conflict and tension is hard to tolerate in the office, but it's a Band-Aid you got to kind of rip off. And the earlier you identify the illness and the more aggressive the treatment at the beginning, the better the prognosis. And you know, we all know these are lifelong, potentially chronic illnesses for some people. And about half of people recover, but about half of people don't. And so for me in pediatrics, I am extremely motivated by the idea that the actions that I take for this teenager who doesn't want me to take these actions, like I can really try to change this kid's trajectory. I can really help them have a better life if we can address this upfront. And so I can have a lot of really hard conversations with that in the back of my mind because I'm really eager to motivate. And the last thing I would say is these illnesses have a really bad reputation. I think people like, you know, they have this reputation for being really conflict generating, and they can be, or having really difficult families. But like the families that have eating disorders are just like all the families that have all the other illnesses. And there's really, there are challenges, but there are tremendous rewards. And so I think just trying to have an open mind, don't be afraid of them. Just, you know, call for help or ask for support or read up about it. But you can do it. Pediatricians can do this. And kids will get better faster if pediatricians are willing to do this a little more.
I love this. I think this episode has inspired a lot of PCPs to try to take on the screening and diagnosis and treatment of these types of disorders. And for our listeners, is there anything else that you think they should go check out? Anything you'd like to plug or send our listeners to?
There is a really good book that I still use all the time. It's pretty short, and I know people aren't so into books anymore, but it's really a wonderful resource. It's by Philip Mailer and Arnold Anderson. And it's called Eating Disorders, A Comprehensive Guide to Medical Care and Complications. It's in its fourth edition. It was just published for the most recent time in 2022. And it's just a really good sort of desk side reference, easy to read, easy to understand, pretty comprehensive. So I would encourage you to check that out. And then, you know, there are lots of webinars and conferences and things. The eating disorder treating community is pretty committed and a wonderful group of people. So come to a conference sometime or try to network in your local area. Because if you build a small network, you can really, it makes it a lot easier to do the work.
This is awesome. I'm going to get a copy for our Cash Lock Clinic. This has been a great episode. We really appreciate you taking the time. I mean, this was amazing. Very helpful for, I think, a lot of different people who are going to listen to this show. So thank you for sharing your time, your expertise. Thanks for coming on.
It was a pleasure. This is so fun.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review our show on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, or email us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producers for this episode, Sydney Engel and Beck Raymond Colker, our showrunner Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I've been Justin Lee Burke.
I've been Sydney Engel.
And this has been Chris the Chew Man Chew. Thank you. Good night. And if you've made it all the way to the end, here's an AI-generated poem. In a tale softly spun of shadows and light, a youth wandered in fear of the bite. Where dread held sway in the silence of night, a journey began from darkness to bright. See, whispered wisdom, with care and with love, from shadows below to the brightness above, where food is not foe, but kin and friend, to nourish and heal, to mend and to tend. With colors so bold and strokes wide and free, the youth found beauty in what there could be. Each meal a canvas, once empty and cold, now a story of warmth, of bravery bold. In this tender battle, where fears slowly fade, a symphony of tastes and joy is played, a revelation born from within the heart, where eating is healing, an artful start. See you guys.